In this week's episode of the First Moves podcast, we're talking to Alexander Martins, co-founder of Clipstake, an investment platform where you can invest directly in your favorite YouTube content creators. We're discussing how he started this and how his complex university relationship has helped him in his company. We're also discussing his unique way of handling learning from his mistakes and how you might be able to take this into your personal life. So please give this episode a listen. Welcome, Alex, to the First Moves podcast. We're really happy to have you on here.
Thank you for having me.
Could you maybe start off with telling us a little bit about who you are and how you ended up studying here in Maastricht?
Yes, so I'm Alexandre Martens. I'm from Belgium, from Tervuren, which is a little city right under... I mean, I think we can call it more like a town than a city, right under Brussels. And yeah, I mean, I came to Maastricht because of the PBL system, I think like the majority of the people. Because the system in Belgium, how it works is you have two big sessions. So every semester you have one big exam sessions from 6 to 8 courses. And that's all at once. And you have 2 or 3 weeks to pass them all. So how it kind of works is the first month or months you kind of party, you know, like, ah, I will study later. And then you have something called the blocus, where you actually need to get to work and then you try to pass as many exams as possible. So yeah, I think that's not the optimal way for information retention. Like, I don't think you can just push yourself for a month and a half and make sure you remember all that information efficiently. So that's one of the reasons why I came to Maastricht, is just because it's segmented. Course by course, 3 courses a period in my faculty at least. And yeah, it just the workload, I think, is then more constant, which is great. And then obviously for the international aspect and the English speaking aspect, which I think is very important.
What sparked your interest in data science and entrepreneurship and coming here also for the data science above the PBL system?
Yeah. So I came here for data science, for the program of data science, just because my interest in data science started really when I was young. I started programming. I was always busy with computers. And some hardware stuff, like I like to modify, you know, like those electric scooters. I just like took them apart and tried to make a better one. Tried to make a better one, but it ended up always more shitty, you know, like, I don't know why, but skill, lack of skill. No, but... on a more serious note, I heard a lot of good things about the data science program here in Maastricht, and I was very interested into coding, so that's why I picked it. And I mean, it's not far from home, like an hour and a half.
What kind of projects did you build as a kid, and what things did you program?
So what I built was, so I have my neighbors, which are also one of my best friends. They have the same age, literally next door. And we used to build some, I mean, those small scooters, we just took them apart and we tried to reassemble them. We tried to mod them, you know, like add some features on it and just have fun with what we had in the garage and try to make something, like upgrade something, where usually we ended up breaking it. Or like the purpose was to reassemble it afterwards, and then it just laid there like disassembled, and we just didn't know what to do with it. So a lot of hands-on, and then later on programming. We had some programming classes in school. I really liked it, and so yeah, I really tried to push myself at every class to make sure, because I'm a pretty competitive guy, so I really wanted to make sure that the shit I was posting, I don't know if I can swear in this podcast.
Yeah, you're fine.
The shit that I was making had to be the best one. And I would be pissed if someone else had better than me. So I had a bit of a toxic competitive aspect. And that really pushed me to be good at programming. And I really enjoyed it. And so that's why I ended up picking programming.
I think that competitiveness also helped you now in what you're doing with Clipstake and YouTube, the two companies that you have. Can you describe the first time you realized that you wanted to have something of your own in the form of a company?
Yes, so Everything really started after the first year and a half of uni, where I was really questioning some of the courses I was studying, especially in the mathematical field. Like, I wasn't really going to go into the mathematical side of data science. So I was really wondering, what the fuck am I doing? I don't see any application for it. So I kind of put my studies on pause and kind of dropped out. Like, I just sent an email to uni. I think I said, like, yeah, you guys are, like, useless. Bye, you know. And then I was there without uni. And I just knew that I wanted to do something on my own just because I knew that what I was going to learn was going to be useful and I'm going to enjoy doing it. And I just didn't enjoy some of the subjects at school because I didn't immediately see the use case of it. So that really demotivates me, demotivated me. And so that's why also I dropped out, and then I started building stuff on my own. And I just enjoyed the process of brainstorming an idea, try to figure out how I'm going to work, how I'm going to make it work, trying to see what skill sets I need to acquire. So if it's certain programming language, if it's hardware or whatever, trying to find create a little plan. But I don't know shit about how to build it. So I'm really enjoying the process of knowing nothing and having that learning journey to become, I wouldn't say an expert, far from that, but just knowledgeable about the field. And that's really what I like, just the learning curve of getting there and then applying what I learned to something I enjoy building.
I think that's also one of those factors that I can relate to a lot, is I have no clue about engineering, yet I chose to start a company where the biggest product that we have is hardware.
Yeah.
And I have no idea how to do this. So I'm also in that trying to become more knowledgeable at that part. So I can relate to that, what you're saying, a lot with trying to figure out how to get there. What are the first steps that you took towards entrepreneurship when you went into uni or when you dropped out of uni?
So the first steps, I don't know if they were first steps, like, you're a bit lost. That's where you start. Like, you just, you know you want to build something. Maybe you already have an idea. You just don't know really where to start. I think especially in the beginning when you're doing those first projects, you have an idea, you immediately want to build it and you'll figure out about the way. I think it's important to first really define what you want to build and then the value proposition of your product and then making sure there is demand. So before you start building, make sure that you go to the people who might be clients and say, hey guys, does this sound interesting to you? Would you maybe use it? And really go around and make sure there is demand before putting all that time and effort into a product that you're probably going to enjoy building, but there is also an enjoyment part where, or a satisfaction part where the product that you put so much work into is actually getting used. And if you can't, obviously it's not 100% guarantee, but if you already see that there is demand, it might also motivate you when you have a little dip, you know? And at least when your product is ready, you can go to the market and people will probably use it. Because I made the mistake in the beginning of doing a product and then I loved the process, spent a year building it, and I was like, what's market research? And I was like, oh, fuck. So I just spent a year building a product that I saw a vision for, but no one is using. And they're like, shit. But the lesson I got out of it is the whole learning curve that I got, and that's where my skill set is today. It's just because of that startup that I coded from scratch before ChatGPT. So it's actual coding, you know, like if you had a problem, you actually go to Stack Overflow, which is like a forum where you can ask coding questions and people answer, and then you get ranked based on how relevant your answers are. And these were the old days, you know. Now it's just, I don't know, when you look at the project I made in my first coding project, like, you can do it now in 2-3 months. I took a whole year to make it. So AI is really, it's nuts. It's really nuts. Yeah.
What was that first project?
So that first project was called VFund, VFUND.io. And the basic idea was that it's a decentralized fund based on voting. So, you know, like you have a fund with different assets in it. And what you can have is voting shares that then rebalance the fund weekly. So to maybe give it a clearer picture is you have a basket of fruits and everyone has a voting right. Everyone has a say. And every week you can say, hey, guys, we're adding an apple, removing a banana. Hey, guys, we're adding a pineapple and removing passion fruit. So we rebalance the fund every week. And it pays off dividend if the fund is in profit every week. So if you start at 100 and it ends up at 110, well, 10%, I mean, you get the 10 out. So the profit of 10 gets out. You reinvest 5 and then you distribute the dividends 5 between all the voting parties. And that was on the blockchain. So everything happened with a smart contract. So it's decentralized in a way that there is no controlling entity who has admin access to the funds. Like it's in a smart contract. If no one votes, the funds are there. We can't touch them. They're just there. You know, like there is no authority on it. And the assets would be crypto assets. So you have Bitcoin, Ethereum, et cetera, et cetera. So those are the assets in the fund. The fund, weekly voting, dividends, on half of the profit, and then the other half of the profit gets reinvested for compounding. And if it's in a loss, no dividends get distributed, and hopefully the analysis, you know, like it was a lot based on technical analysis because I did a lot of technical analysis when I dropped out, because you know everyone has a bit of a stock phase where you think you're like, stocks, I know my shit, like all of that, and then you lose a bunch of money and. That's basically usually what happens. So I was just passionate about that. Yeah, all those finance, the finance side of things. And I wanted to put that in practice with my coding. And then the blockchain was also something. So I was like, blockchain, my limited finance knowledge that I needed to deepen. And then coding all together, soup, VFund. And then I launched it. I mean, I never actually launched it because I got a bit burned out of it. But some people used it. It worked, but I never did the full push of the project. So that's also something I was... after working a year on a project, you feel a bit exhausted. And especially alone, you lack the motivation of, you know, like, you have something now, there is this other effort where you have to market it, push it, and... At that time, that was for sure not my strongest asset. Like, I just preferred staying home and code like a nerd.
Starting something alone is really, really tough. Because you, at least for me, like, I didn't get the chance with my second company, Aurori, at first to bounce around the ideas with other people. I could, but not in an official setting. So then, like, adding advisors to the board was really a good move. But even then, you have to make use of it. And otherwise, at least for me, I would just get caught in my own headspace.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't get the feedback because the process is so long that the gratification you get out of it is delayed by years. And at some point, your internal, like intrinsic motivation can run out in that regard if you're reliant. Actually, then it's extrinsic motivation. If you're reliant on these rewards and if that doesn't come, yeah, you'll feel burnt out. I had the exact same thing happen as well. So. I think it's a very common pitfall that a lot of people go through.
Yeah.
And it's you can move fast, but you can't really go as far when you're alone. Yeah.
Definitely. I think that's one of the lessons also I took out of doing some startups is don't do it alone. Like, don't. Just don't. Period. You can try, but you'll see it's hard to keep the energy, the motivation, the discipline. And you just can't be an expert in all fields required to run a business. You just can't. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't, I believe.
I'm quite intrigued now to find out where the interest in the financial sector came from, because you also have your startup Clipstake, which is the YouTube investment platform. We'll dive into that in a bit as well. Where did the interest come for doing the financial stuff?
the financial aspect or my financial interest, I think, really came when I dropped out. Because I was really first focused, I wanted to be a coder, right? So finance wasn't really my plus. Like, I've always been interested in investing, following like the rates, etc. But it wasn't my primary focus, nor like it never captivated me. Like, I would never read a book about finance, at least before I dropped out. And when I dropped out, there was that crypto boom. There was that GME. That was crazy, bro. GME was crazy. Short squeeze. AMC. All those stuff. And I just got intrigued. Like, how does all this work? Like, and so I dug deeper. I went on those Discord channels. The people were just passionate, just pumping out information, and then you just get a source here, a source there. You just learn, you try to cross-reference, try to find links, etc. And you just learn so quickly. There's so much information out there that even if you don't know shit about the subject, if you want to learn, you can learn, and it's free. It's literally free. And depending on your motivation or how interested you are, you're going to learn crazy fast. The pitfall is that you need to be careful about making sure that you don't only focus on one aspect, because usually it's a broader field, and your interest, or you need to make sure that your knowledge field knows what there is to know, and then that you dive deeper into a subject. Not that you just dive deeper into a subject and then don't know what the rest is. So I think, yeah, I kind of call it like the knowledge web, where it's very important that you know that things exist without being an expert, or an expert is an overstatement, without being knowledgeable about a certain subject. But that's, I think, what's missing a lot with people nowadays, is you need to know what exists. You know, we're becoming too focused on specific things. And then we're like, oh, actually, does this exist? Yeah, it does exist. Oh, okay. Well, I don't know really how to explain it, but it's just important. And I think that comes with curiosity.
So if someone listening to this podcast right now wants to start getting into investment, into the financial market, into the financial world, what would your advice be on where to go to find the best information possible on this?
I think probably definitely... I think university to start is definitely a good move. Yes, for that, I think university has like a good structure to provide you with all necessary information. I'm not a finance expert. I'm just like a guy who played around with crypto, a guy who played around with stocks. It was trial and error. And I just took lessons out of it that I could have avoided by going to uni, you know, because there were some very basic things that I didn't know about, and I made the mistake, and they're stupid mistakes. But depending on how knowledgeable you are, you can skip some of the failure steps. You definitely need to go through failure steps, but uni... definitely gives you a small step ahead or a big step ahead. So uni, I would say, and then YouTube, a lot of good content on there, and then some Discord servers or just servers, group chats in general.
Nice. I think it's also nice that you say now that you also burned your fingers on some of the things that you learned the hard way. And I think sometimes also for me, obviously, I learned some stuff during my international business studies here in business, but you can't learn everything. Like you say, there's always going to be knowledge gaps in between certain things. So even though I went to university, I also burnt my fingers on a lot of stuff, especially in the stock market, because I didn't learn anything about that during my studies. And I thought I was the king of everything at some point. And then I made some money, I invested again, I lost everything. So that's my financial market curve. Now I'm just doing some more conservative investments because I learned from it as well. So I think it's a good thing also to share that you do burn your fingers at some point doing this, and you're going to lose some money at some point.
Yeah.
I think also what's important is that when you zoom out, you see that, like, it's kind of a cliche, but everybody makes mistakes, but not everybody learns. And so you can fail. And there's a lot of people who do fail at certain things, or they don't meet the standards, or they don't reach their goals. And that's completely fine because it happens to everyone. But then the question is, then how do you truly learn from it? And I mean, that's something I'm learning myself, is how to not make the same mistakes twice. Because I think there's also a notion where, you know, now we love this idea of failing because you learn from it. But a lot of people are just accepting the failure and then just not doing anything with it, which I think then is a massive mistake, because you're missing out on super valuable lessons, which if you don't take them into account, you'll be back at the same spot 6 months down the line with less money, maybe less time, and well, wasted energy. So to me, that's a personal point of reflection, because failure gets so glorified, but
yeah,
it's really the learning that should be glorified, not the failure.
Yeah.
But I think the conversation needs to always go hand in hand on that front.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I think a good thing to do is, you know, when there is a failure, you don't always know when there is a lesson, because, I mean, a lesson in the sense that it could have been a failure, but it wasn't. And sometimes it's luck, sometimes it's skills, and you don't always see them, because you just, oh, success after success after success. You're not always aware of, oh, this was actually the origin of my next step that succeeded, right? And when you fail, you know you failed. And so I think when you fail, what's very important is that you just keep like a notebook or something like this. That's what I'm doing. And you just write what your mistake was. And then just take some time of thinking about, okay, this is how I went to that mistake. That was like the build up. And how could I do it better next time based on what I know now? You know, like, what's the lesson? Like you said, just keep that in a notebook somewhere. And then over the months, years, it's going to get filled. 1 page, 5 pages, 10 pages, 15 pages. And once a month or twice a month, just read again through them. And it's very simple, but you tend to sometimes forget mistakes, forget how you solve them. So keeping track of them and reminding you of, oh, okay, that's what I did. It didn't lead to a good outcome. That's what I learned out of it. Maybe I should remember that and make sure I don't do twice the same mistake. So by writing it down, it helps.
Absolutely. I use the same technique as well. But what I add to it now is talking to people about it who are in similar situations, because especially when you do something alone, then you can miss an outside perspective to see other factors that you maybe missed out on, because you're largely naive. And so what I find really valuable is talking to friends who make similar decisions day in, day out, and then they will look at the mistake that I made in a different way. Mm-hmm. And then that made me understand very fundamental mistakes that I made strategically that screwed over, you know, some of my projects, while my initial attribution of the fault was something else.
Yeah.
'Cause I think when we're competitive or we want to do really well, we're also super hard on ourselves because we want to improve. But sometimes you misattribute it to you as a person rather than a certain behavior or a certain piece of information that you maybe didn't have. And then if that's the real answer, then that's the actual lesson. So for me, that external perspective mm-hmm. is always super important as well, as a way to like level up the notebook technique, if you want to call it that.
Maybe to change the pace a little bit here, you co-founded Clipstake here together with Felix.
Yes.
What was your motivation to start Clipstake, and what is Clipstake?
So Felix once approached me and he was like, "Hey, Alex, nice to meet you." I didn't know who the guy was. I was like, "Hi, nice to meet you. My name is Felix." I forgot his name the next day because I'm very bad with names. So I was like, "Ah, okay, hi, Felix." And then he just pitched me the idea of, you know, it would be great if you know, we can invest in content creators, and I think this is how we would do it. And then we started a bit thinking, critical thinking about the idea together in the streets, literally after a Sigma investment meeting. And then we just went for a coffee, and there he elaborated a bit on his vision for it. And then that's where we went, we got together and really were going to dig deeper into what he was putting on the table, right? So we're like, oh, okay. So he had an idea. I had some of the practical expertise in the blockchain part, in the implementation part. And that's where our two brains really got together, and we really tried to find a way of implementing the idea. So because an idea is nice, but then there is that next step of trying to implement it and make it feasible. And so we got together, we brainstormed it, and then we found a way of making it. We found a way of where we could probably make it work. And what's really nice about Felix is that we, first of all, it's a super guy. He's a smart guy, very sharp German guy. So he's good in finance. I mean, not all German guys are good in finance, no, but a very skilled guy. So I'm very fortunate for that. And then also we complement each other extremely well. I'm more of the tech guy, so implementation of the technology, all of that aspect. And then he's more into the development side, the business side. Also, that's one of his skill sets, is he studied at university for business. So in that way, we're really complementary of each other. And so we started to work on Clipstake. And Clipstake is a platform where you and me can invest in content creators. So the idea was, or everything started from a vision that we had, or a FOMO. It started from a FOMO, where we saw our favorite content creators just grow from 50,000 to 1 million, 5 million, 10 million subscribers. And we were like, hey, I was there at the start. You know, like sometimes on YouTube, on YouTube videos, and they have like 8,000 subscribers. And then you open the comment section, because we have such a short attention span where just watching the video is not enough. You need to also scroll the comments at the same time, you know. They say, oh, I'm here, remember me. I'm like, this channel is going to blow up. Remember me, one of the first ones here, 8K subscribers. Anyways, so we saw an opportunity where people could really relate to channels, and they can really see a vision for that channel to grow. And it's kind of the same as stocks, right? We see a company with potential. If it's listed, we might want to do due diligence and then maybe buy some shares of that company. Well, Clipstake wanted to incorporate the same concept in a way that, as a content creator, what you can do on Clipstake is you can announce your upcoming videos and invite your audience to invest in that video. Now, what you get in return is you get a share of the future ad revenue of that video. So you don't invest in the whole channel, but you only invest in a specific video. And whenever that video is going to get released, you will get a percentage of the ad revenue that's going to be, that's going to come back to you, like a dividend on stocks. It's basically the concept of having a stock being the YouTube video itself, and the dividend of that stock being the dividend of the ad revenue of that video. So that's how we wanted to implement it in Clipstake. And with the money that the creator gets from announcing those videos and his followers just investing in the videos, he gets up from capital to create better content and accelerate his growth. And then on the other side, as an investor, you get to support your favorite content creator, and you also get to capitalize on their growth. Because as the channel grows, so does the ad revenue on those videos, and so is your return on investment. Usually it grows. I mean, that's the assumption we have.
What was the factor that guided the decision to focus on individual videos rather than channel as a whole? Because it's like it's betting on a new product that Apple might bring out instead of Apple as a company. So what was the thought process behind that?
Yes, that's a very good point. So by speaking to creators, if you invest in a world channel, you're literally taking part of something that's them, right? When you're making a YouTube channel, it's literally your baby. And by taking a whole share of their channel, you're taking away a whole share of their baby, like you're taking the leg, you know, or two legs. So they weren't comfortable with giving such a big part away. And maybe as they grow way bigger, they won't need the financing anymore, because it's really like a Kickstarter, you know, like you're small, you need the funding, you go on Clipstake, you raise the funding, it accelerates your growth. And then at some point, well, you don't have to raise money anymore. And the followers were there in the beginning. Well, they get to profit from everything you do after. So for not it to be too impactful for the YouTuber, and really like leaving his creativity where he wants to go. Because if you buy shares of a YouTube channel, after if he changes his content and you don't really like it anymore, well, you're kind of stuck with it. You know, I mean, you can always sell and exactly. But if you really like, it's also releasing videos, specific videos also can give you a direction of what your subscribers like and don't like. You can take it as, you know, an indicator of, oh, they always invest in my adventurous content, like the videos I want to do with where, I don't know, I'm riding motorbikes, but whenever I'm riding, I don't know, bicycles, no one wants to invest because it's boring. So it also, you can, like, you know, orient yourself in the direction you want to go and try to capture that interest of the audience.
So it's really leveraging the win-win relationship that's usually already there between an audience and a content creator, increasing that, but not to the point where you're choking it. Because if you invest $10 and they blow up to have 10 million subscribers, and your dividends is, you know, thousands and thousands of euros, then indeed the content creator is going to feel choked. You got extremely lucky in some respect, or you made the right call. But then indeed the win-win situation is so out of balance then, where you're probably choking the fundamental thing that caused it in the first place.
Yeah.
So, exactly. Right.
Yeah.
So to me, this whole idea sounds like a very novel idea. Like, I haven't heard about this anywhere before. Are there any competitors right now that are already doing this? Or are you guys really the first ones who came up with this idea to invest in YouTube videos like this?
So there is, we have one competitor in the United States. And what they do is they take a share of the world channel, which is a very intrusive approach. And they have about, I think, 15 creators onboarded that basically sell the ad revenue of their world channels. But they're only operating in the US because you need special licenses for it because it's an investment. And then we have other indirect competitors in other industries, for example, the music industry, where you tokenize music. So the revenue of music, you can buy tokens, which represent, it's like Clipstake. Like, you buy the ad revenue gets tokenized in Clipstake, and you can buy those tokens, and each token is entitled to a dividend payout, right, of the ad revenue. Well, it's the same in music. They tokenize the revenue of a music album, for example. You got to buy a share of it, and then whenever it becomes a hit and it generates ad revenue, you get to get some dividends from it. So I don't think we were fully aware, to be honest, about that existing before we came up with the idea and the implementation. But yeah, we did some research afterwards, and we actually found out that there are some similar industries, but not really. I mean, there are some similar concepts, but not in the content creator space. And because attention nowadays is the new gold, it's a good implementation of that technology into the content creator space.
It's nice to hear also that there are other people doing it, but in a different way than what you guys are doing. So it's really novel what you guys have come up with doing the actual video part of it instead of the whole channel, which is going to get a lot of benefits to the content creators, I guess, in the end as well. About last year, November, I think, I had the privilege to pitch at the Start competition where you guys also pitched, and maybe not so good for me, but you guys won and I became second. You guys actually won the challenge and got sent off to St. Gallen, where they had the Start to Summit conference. How did winning this competition and actually coming to St. Gallen help your company, and how did it help you grow?
So that competition was very interesting because there were a lot of good startups, and congrats for coming second.
Thank you very much. It still hurts. It still hurts.
Next time better. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. No, we got fortunate in a sense that yes, we won that competition, and by going there, it really opened our eyes on the entrepreneurial space. And honestly, I really, really recommend every single one that's a bit interested in startups and entrepreneurship to go to the St. Gallen event, which is in May or something else, somewhere like that. And oh boy, it's so cool. It's really so cool. You just got to meet all like-minded people, and you have all those stands, and just you have an after party after, which is amazing, and you have free food. And then there is a hackathon right next to it. So you got to go and see the hackers, you know, like building their project where they have two and a half days to build it. So it's really like a build mindset space, you know, like everyone you talk has a project. And then sometimes you talk to someone and then you make a connection with another idea that enhances your idea indirectly, you know. So it's really an indirect brainstorming environment. So it really opened our eyes on also some novel things that we would like to implement in Clipstay, but then also some valuable connections we made, definitely, because there were some speed dating events, etc., with content creators and also with content agencies, so channel managers, who that's also an industry, as there are some companies who manages channels to put a link between sponsorships, sponsors, and the channels itself. So they act as an intermediary, whatever how you pronounce it, as a middleman. And so yeah, we got in touch with some of those, and they were interested, etc. So it really opened our eyes on, yes, new things we want to implement in Clipstay, and partnerships and new connections.
And then parallel to having won the Start Challenge here in Maastricht, you also were part of the Maastricht University Challenge, and you actually made it to the final in this as well. What was your biggest takeaway from the experience of partaking in the Maastricht University Challenge as opposed to the Start one as well?
So I was very impressed by the amount of startups here in Maastricht. Because how the Maastricht University Challenge works is you have checkpoints, and at every checkpoint leading up to the main final pitching competition, a lot of startups get eliminated. And in the beginning, one of the first stages is everyone has a small stand and presents their startups. And then you have some experts and some other or like the organizers and other companies who come, and they look at your idea, and then they evaluate your idea, and then based on the interest, the half of them goes through and the other half, or I don't know what the percentage is anyways. So at every single stage, a lot of companies get canceled. And it was really interesting to see how many companies there are here in Maastricht, and seeing that there is that entrepreneurial will. So that's, I would say that's one of the main takeaways that I saw. That's maybe not directly related to Clipsteak. Definitely like the experience that you get, because at the end of the day, when you start a company, like, you need to learn how to pitch. I'm not the greatest pitcher, but every time you pitch, you get into a discomfort zone and you get a tiny bit better. So it was an opportunity to get better. It was an opportunity to get visibility. It was an opportunity to, which we definitely got. And it was also an opportunity to get feedback, which is very important, critical feedback. So that was good. And we didn't win. A lot of other startups won, and because there were multiple prizes, and they were very interesting startups too. So I'm very glad that they got the spotlight too. We got the spotlight in RTSS, Road to Start Summit. We can't be in everything, unfortunately.
So during the first year of running Clipsteak, what has been the biggest obstacle or hurdle you've had to jump to get further?
So first it was building the prototype. Whenever that went out of the way, we faced another hurdle, which was how we were going to do the outreach and get to those creators and get to those investors and see if there is demand. I mean, we kind of did that in parallel with building the prototype. So at least we did, because I said in the beginning of the podcast, first, before start building, try to make sure there is demand. I mean, we asked a bit around, there was kind of demand, but we also needed to confirm the demand on the creator side, right? So while I was building the prototype, Felix was doing the outreach, and there we confirmed that there actually was demand. And it's just, it was hard to, I mean, Felix can definitely talk more about it. I'll tell you more about it, but it was very hard to get to those creators and actually get a response. Because obviously they don't want to put their email out there so that all their subscribers are sending them emails. Well, oh, I love your content, or like blackmailing them, or I don't know what. You know, people are crazy those days sometimes. So it's hard to get their contacts, and then it's even harder to get a response. So that was definitely a hurdle to really get those creators, some of the creators, onboarded. And now the next hurdle we're tackling right now is the funding part. So then we found out that obviously we're dealing with financial assets, so we need a license for that. The license is expensive. So we found a law firm that's ready to help us with that. They have a clear path of how they're going to make it possible. The only thing that's missing is the cash. So that's where we're at now. We're raising money for Clipsteak to pass that step and then just ready to go. Like, Clipsteak is ready to go. We have demand on both sides. We just need that legal check that gets ticked, and which is quite capital intensive.
So you mentioned that you're now in the stage of having to get the funding to pay for the lawyers to get all this through. How are you approaching getting this funding for Clipsteak?
So, good question. So first, we just get the business plan in order, all the data that an investor would like to see. So there is a business plan, maybe the financial model if they're interested in it. I think nowadays it's just better to get a one-on-one interview or just to go to see the investor and just talk to them. I think that's also how it's mainly done. But just get all the information that they would maybe need or like to look at. So making sure that your data room, we call it data room, is really a little folder that you can share with all the data in it. So that's one. Second, so whenever you have that, second point is you need to try to find people where you can send your little link folder to and try to pitch it. So there are lists of investors that you can find everywhere on the internet. Just mass send them. You have nothing to lose. You send 100 emails, maybe one is going to say, okay, I'll take an interview. And then attend events. So we're very fortunate because we're followed by the Maastricht Center of Entrepreneurship. and they invite us to some events. And on the 26th of September, there is an event in Roermond, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And there we have the chance to pitch. And the event is specifically for fundraising. So we have to get that pitch perfect. So yeah, now it's funding. And it's very interesting because it's uncharted territory, right? We have to navigate it. Predrag and Roy help us a lot for that. They give good insights, but yeah, for Felix and I, we don't know how it's gonna go, and we're sure we're gonna learn shitloads while doing it. And I think it's gonna be a long process, probably, and painful process, but we'll get there. It's a step that needs to be taken.
Yeah, I definitely think it's also like a numbers game. Like we spoke about this before we started recording the podcast episode, that with these fundings, it's just really getting out to as many people as possible. And then you hope that one or two or maybe three are going to contact you. And then that one of them then says, yes, we're going to go for this. Mm-hmm. But in the meanwhile, you have to survive on something. Have you guys been granted any subsidies or grants already in the past that lead up to this fundraising event now?
So for now, we're fully bootstrapped and we didn't get any external grant or help from the government, or maybe we should actually look into it. But yeah, for now, there wasn't really a big need. But now that we actually need the money, because we didn't really need the money before, or at least not a significant amount. But now that we actually need a significant amount, we're really looking to every single opportunity. So there is raising funding from investors, there is grants, like you mentioned, maybe not a loan. That's a bit high risk, and I don't know if, you know, banks would give you a loan for a startup like that. But yeah, grants and investments are the two things that we're looking for.
Nice. It's a very exciting time now that you're getting to the point where you need the money to come in now. So it's really this, all or nothing kind of period. What excites you when you look at the future the most about Clipstake and what's about to come?
What excites me the most is that there will be a lot of creators that I think it will really filter out good content with bad content. In a way that I think content creation is slowly moving to, for now it's getting a lot more and more with AI, and it's annoying. Like you're scrolling or you're watching a video and you hear like a AI voiceover or some shit and you're like, what the fuck? So it's harder to find that niche quality content. And so we're very excited about making sure that the content that people want has visibility and really gets to be pushed there and has a big chance of getting traction quickly. And it also hits the algorithm, right? If you're very successful very quickly, usually you get some traction from the algorithm, so you get more visibility. I mean, it's just a snowball effect for qualitative content, not quantity. Like a lot, both is important, don't get me wrong, but there are just more and more channels that are just garbage. And I think with YouTube, with Clipstake, sorry, YouTube is another thing. With Clipstake, we'll be able to filter that. And we're just excited that people can be part of a success story. And that just honestly what motivates me is having that idea of, yeah, I saw stocks going up and woohoo, not having that FOMO and being actually being able to act and be part of the journey of a creator and support that creator. Because what Patreon does or other platforms is you basically give them money, right? And you support their content, etc. But you don't really have something in return. And with Clipstake, you get something in return. So it's like basically an investment. I mean, it's a win-win from both sides, right? So it's Patreon on steroids.
So in the really long term, what is the big impact you're trying to create with Clipstick, and when do you kind of say, this is the product we wanted to build all along, or the service we wanted to build all along? At what point do you say, this is it, or does it never get to that point?
First, we need to test the market and having users, because the vision we have for Clipstick will probably not match the vision that... No, I will rephrase it. We have a vision for Clipstick, but the current product or the offer that we have might not be a perfect fit for the investors or the creators. So that's why we need to really craft something that we need, we're kind of obsessed of making sure that the creator has everything that he wants on the platform to use it. That's really what we're now focused on. And it might, and it's going to change of what we're currently offering. Because what we're currently offering is just two dudes knowing a bit about YouTube and thinking like, yeah, this might actually be what they need. But now that we get those creators onboarded, we're seeing that there is a big delta between a difference that there is a big difference between what we thought they would need and what they actually need. And so we're adapting our product a bit. So yeah, it's just version after version after version, and the first version is not going to be the same as the second version based on the feedback.
I mean, you're speaking to a question that I wanted to ask earlier, which is where we discussed the novelty of Clipstick. And novelty is very important for making the first move. But more importantly, it's also being or having that last mover advantage, like Peter Thiel says. Thiel, I never know how to say his last name, but he mentions that in 0 to 1 where you have first mover advantage, but it's usually very overrated because people can come in and just improve on what you already have because they see improvements that they can make. So how do you plan to keep that learning cycle, so to speak, so tight that you can make sure that Clipstick also has that last mover advantage, that you guys become the name in this field?
Mm-hmm. So... it's a very good question. So the industry we're entering, especially on the way we're doing it, is not very... it's not an easy industry to start in the sense that it's very capital intensive. Why? Because of the licenses. So that demotivates already a lot of people. Now, obviously, it doesn't demotivate everyone. So if someone wants to do the same, they're probably going to do the same or with... a little twist. So what we're really trying to do is to stay as close as possible to both the investors and the creators and really listening to their feedback and trying to implement what they say as quick and in a way that makes sense and that doesn't break. Yeah, okay, that's software, like with no bugs. Okay, so making sure that the new features we're sending out is not based on what we think is nice or, oh, maybe it's really based on the feedback. Hey, guys, I really need this extra field. And we get it from 2-3 people. Up, we can make it an optional feature in the next version that we're pushing out. So making sure that we really try to satisfy all the content creators and also the investors with features without obviously going to one-on-one. But if the average says, the average goes. So making sure that we're very, very close to the community and to the people who are actually paying for the services. So that's, I think, where we really need to stand out, is a very close community, listening to the community. I think the bigger you become, the less you listen. With Clipstick, we really need to stay low on that side and be obsessed with what people want. Because sometimes, I mean, the majority of the time, it's just people saying, hey, guys, this would be nice on Clipstick, you know, and it's maybe on a random post on Reddit. Well, you know, you need to be active and see, oh, yeah, actually, that's a good idea. And, you know, you tag the guy so he feels some recognition. And like, shout out to this guy because the feature was suggested by him, you know. And so creating a link with the audience, I think, is very important.
Yeah, and setting up in a way... indeed, giving the recognition so you build it into a feedback loop,
yes.
Not with feedback as we're talking about, but where people are constantly contributing ideas. Because once you have that as an asset, you have 1,000 minds or 10,000 or 100,000 minds working towards a problem rather than two. And that's when you go, as we said earlier, really far and not just fast. So it sounds like a solid approach.
Yeah, and also it's always nice to be just someone behind their screen. And if you actually have a good idea and see that there is a platform out there, that that platform actually listens to you and implements a small feature of that. And it's always very rewarding, and it also creates brand loyalty, you know? So I really think that the community aspect that we need to create is very important. And a lot of companies lack that nowadays. It's too corporate. It's too... We need to just say sexy, cool. I mean, it's easier said than done, but we really need to stay low, and we don't have to be, you know, like on top and be unreachable. We really need to be reachable and work like that up to a certain scale, obviously, but really try as long as possible. I really believe that that's a good approach.
So when you look at the future and you envision your own kind of career path, what do you envision at the end of that? Like, what do you want to build towards with your own career, not just with Clipstick or YouTube?
Definitely having an impact on people, in the sense that it would give them a new opportunity to do something or better their lives, or sounds very cliche, but just having an impact or giving access to something that wasn't there before and that helps them out. Like we're doing at Clipstick, where we're giving them an opportunity to capitalize on the growth of the creator, or giving an opportunity to the creator to be closer to their audience and to accelerate their growth. Or with YouTube, where we're basically a platform that connects students and tutors. So it's basically like a marketplace where we cut out kind of the middleman, and we make tutoring affordable for both sides. So that has a big impact on the students here in Maastricht. So having an impact and having platforms that affect people in a way or another, hopefully in a positive way.
It sounds like you want to help people realize their potential, at least for me as like an outsider, because it's like you want to help people leverage the skill set, the ideas that they already have with Clipstick, for example, but they just need an extra push or some extra resources, and you want to give it to them. I'm not saying this is it, right? But it's just my perspective. And then also with the YouTube, helping people realize their skills and potential through that, which I think is a very cool thing to be building towards. And I think that's what excites me, at least about like the younger generation of entrepreneurs, is that we want to build things that, yeah, make money, but also do good. And I think that's a pretty epic thing, because organizations have such a huge impact on the world. If we can all build organizations that are awesome, then the world is going to be awesome. So I think that's, hats off. That sounds dope.
In this room, we're all building some cool stuff, I think we can be proud of. Yeah, it's really cool, bro. I really enjoy. I think you guys too enjoy the process of the grind and seeing that it's actually reward. Like you have a feeling when you're building something and people use it and they're happy and they're saying like, "Hey, this is a super product." It you get some satisfaction, and that keeps me motivated for sure. Yeah.
I think that builds a very good bridge into the closing tradition that we have here on the podcast, where we ask our guests to bring an object that has significant value to them, either in their personal or business life. I'm very curious to see, what did you bring with you as your object?
Yes, so I brought a little cube. So it's a cube with, for the listeners, it's a cube with a screen, and then the four adjacent sides are numbers, 5, 10, 30, and 60, which represents minutes. And so based on the orientation you put it on, so for example, I'm showing at the camera the number 60, it makes a timer of 60 minutes. And after the 60 minutes, it buzzes. And that's kind of how I'm trying to keep my workload segmented, in a sense that coding, usually you start, you're going to say, okay, I'm going to solve one bug, and then you end up doing 3 hours of continuous work. And so this little cube kind of remembers me to, you know, you have to stop, take a break, go outside real quick, and then continue. And so it helps to segment the workload, and tries to build some discipline, even though, to be honest, when I still have a bug and the timer of 60 minutes buzzes, I just flip it to the 30-minute timer, and then the 10-minute timer, and then the 5-minute timer, and then I actually stop. But it's a way of creating discipline, and it's a way of keeping track of your productivity level, because you can't be productive for 2 hours straight. So, yeah, it's a nice little gadget. You can buy it on AliExpress. I think everyone should have one on their desk. Like, it just keeps track of the amount of time you're spending on a specific subject, and make sure that you take a break after the 60-minute one, because your brain just needs a small break. And yeah, that's it. Just a little gadget. I'm a gadget guy.
Thank you for tuning into today's episode. If you like today's conversation, please give us a follow on LinkedIn at First Moves. And if you'd like to see more behind-the-scenes content and highlight reels, go give us a follow on Instagram, First Moves Podcast. And please leave a review. It will help us make the podcast better and bring better guests to you in the future. Thank you.